Audio again. For nearly the month of January, we've been studying the last week. The events of the last week surround Christ's life. Okay? And that's setting the stage now all the way up to the point of His being taken, which is where we're studying today. His confrontation in the Garden of Gethsemane, taken before Annas, confrontation associated with that. But it's been fast-paced. Now, we've been studying it slowly, looking at each of the events and the teaching that Jesus has done. But in reality, this has been a quick week. They started out with observance on the prior week, observance of the Sabbath. They are in preparation of what great feast? Passover. Okay? They're making preparation for that. What events happened during this week so far that have been, I'd say, somewhat monumentous to some? How did he enter Jerusalem? Triumphantly. And what did that do? It fulfilled prophecies that had been set in place for centuries. Set the tone for him fulfilling those prophecies. What else took place? In the temple. Cleansed for a second time, wasn't it? And that led to confrontations with the officials there in the temple. It gave Jesus an opportunity to teach them. We also had events that occurred that gave Jesus the opportunity to teach his disciples about the power that they would have coming forward. Can you think of any of those events? What happened on the way into the city one time? They had a pronouncement upon a fig tree. And the next day they observed that what happened to that fig tree? Gone. Dead. As they exit the temple, his disciples have made observations about the temple itself. And what did Jesus say would happen to the temple? Be destroyed, no stone left upon it. But yet, what would happen? Build it back in 3 days. Our study today, the last few statements in our study today, will take exception with that, and they'll be using that statement, the leaders and officials will be using that statement against Jesus, accusing him of blasphemy. Okay? Any other notable event that comes to your mind for this last week? Before we enter into our study today. Okay. You would turn to John chapter 17. As Gary led us in prayer today, it sets the tone. Prayer oftentimes sets the tone for reflection, meditation. There are other aspects of prayer, but oftentimes that's one way when someone is in need, someone is feeling pain, they'll go to their Father in prayer, ask for encouragement, comfort. We see Jesus doing something similar to that here on behalf of who in the last part of chapter 17? His disciples. Jesus is concerned about his disciples. What's going to happen to his disciples in the coming days? They're going to be tested. They're going to be persecuted. They're going to be tried in many ways that they've never experienced before. They've taken ridicule up to this point, but not like they're going to see in the coming days and years. Now, there's a prophecy as well that relates to this. And Jesus prays on behalf of his disciples such that that prophecy itself can be fulfilled. What was it saying about any of his disciples during the events of his death? Some would be lost, save the betrayer. Okay? Let's look at the prayer here on behalf of the disciples. And starting in verse 20, neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which believe on me through their word, that all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. The glory which thou gavest me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as ye are one, I in them, thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, that the world may know that thou hast sent me, and hast loved me, and hast and as thou hast loved me. Over and over he's stating something here in particular. What's that he's stating? He and the Father are one. What is he asking for his disciples to be? That they be likewise. Okay? Father, I will that thou also, whom thou hast given me, be with me where I am, that they may behold my glory which thou hast given me, for thou lovest me before the foundation of the world. And this is the point that I was making earlier. He's praying on behalf of his disciples that he lose none. O righteous Father, the world hath not known thee, but I have known thee. And these have known that thou hast sent me. I have declared unto them thy name, and will declare it, And the love wherewith hast loved me may be in them, and I in them. How's he going to show his love here shortly? Die for him. No greater love hath a man that lay down his life for another. Okay? He's going to be laying down his life for, in the present context, for them, but in eternal context for all of us. Okay. If you would turn with me now to Mark 14, 32 through 42. Any comments on that last section and the prayer associated with it? I think the key point from that is Jesus was truly concerned about his disciples for their faith, praying for them to have encouragement, that they continue to believe, and that, notably, that they be as one. We see that theme repeated throughout the New Testament. One, like-minded. Okay? Starting in Mark 14, 32 through 42. They came into the garden. Jesus and his disciples, or all of the disciples there. And at that point, we're missing one. Judas is missing, okay? But in particular, this is a reference primarily to the 12, less Judas. There were others there potentially as well. We have some, notably one that's a young man that's there in a linen garment that's going to flee and have to flee naked because his garment is taken. But it's going to be a fairly small group. As they enter the garden, we see Jesus taking his disciples, some of them staying there in one place. But who does he take further into the garden with him? Peter, James, and John. It notes that he goes just a bit further. He says in verse 33, he taketh with Peter, James, and John. His heart is very heavy. And saith unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful unto death. Tarry ye here and watch. Okay? He's saying, okay, I want you to come with me just a bit further. I want you to stop. I want you to watch here while I go a bit further away and continue to pray. He's prayed on their behalf now. He's going to change his prayers a bit in the tone of his prayers. He went forward a little and fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible that the hour might pass from him. What hour is he talking about here now? The hour of his death. Okay, as you're talking with young students, it's going to be important that you make these points. Set the context. They may not tie it all together. The hour that he's talking about is not just the immediate time that's occurring, it's the death that he's about to have to endure. That's obvious from the context that we're following on with. He said, Abba, Father, all things are possible unto thee. Take away this cup that we from me. Nevertheless, but not my will, but thou wilt. Oh, if our kids could just really... It's not... that our prayers be answered in the way that we want them to be answered, but in the way that the Father intends to answer, to recognize and accept the wisdom of that answer. In this case, did Jesus already know what the answer was going to be? Almost a rhetorical question in many ways. It's a plea that it could be different, but he knew it had to transpire this way. He knew he was the one that had been prepared. This was the culmination of centuries, if not millennia, of efforts to bring about culmination for a sacrifice on behalf of all mankind. Verse 37, he cometh and findeth, Jesus gets up out of this particular prayer to the Father. He comes back and he finds them sleeping. Who does he find sleeping? Peter, James, and John. At this point, it doesn't say that he found the rest of the disciples sleeping, but it's most notably Peter, James, and John. What were they supposed to be doing? Watching. They were letting them down at this point. Okay? He comes and finds them sleeping and says, Peter, Simon, sleepest thou? Couldst thou not watch 1 hour? Watch ye and pray, lest ye enter into temptation. The spirit is truly ready, but the flesh is weak. Who really needed to hear that particular admonition? Because he's already made rather bold statements up to this point. During the supper, he said, what am I not going to do? Deny you. I'm not going to leave you. I'm ready to do what? Die for you. Okay? But he couldn't stay away. Verse 39, and again he went away, this Jesus, and prayed and spake the same words. And when he returned, he found them sleeping again. Neither wist they what to answer him. To say there, in the King James Version, in parentheses, it says they were asleep for what reason? Tired. Now, they had had the Passover supper, when would that have started? Started late in the evening. It would have started after 6 o'clock. It would have carried forward for a period of time, and we don't know the exact time of this. We know that it's late in the evening. Okay. Verse 41, he comes the third time. So he's gone away. He prayed for them. Gone away. He's come back a second time. He comes a third time and says to them, "Sleep on now. Take your rest. It is enough. The hour is come. Behold, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise up, let us go. And lo, he that betrayeth me is at hand." This particular passage is a bit odd to me in the way that it was worded here. That, first off, what does he tell them? Hey, it's okay for you to sleep. And then next verse he tells them, okay, it's time to get up. But I think the point that he's making here is, had enough sleep now. Yes, it's okay that you've had the sleep now, but it is time now to get up. And I think that would be the point to make from that if anyone questions that particular aspect of it. He says, okay, time is now. What's going to happen to him? He's going to be betrayed. The betrayers are at hand. Okay. As Jesus exits with Peter, James, and John and the other disciples, what next scene transpires in this storyline? There's a mob that comes. Now, had there been mobs before that really tried to take Jesus? There had been mobs around him, but we hadn't seen the leaders really just have huge mobs. Now, another thing, had he been in places that they could have taken him? The Bible makes this point specifically, and Jesus does to them. Wouldn't for fear of the people. Were there lots and lots of people around at this point? Other than the mob that they brought?
Not this night.
No, the mob that was there was a mob of those that wanted to take him specifically. It wouldn't have been a mixed mob of believers and of the officials. The mob that was following this was of the officials that wanted to take him. The people, the Jewish leadership, the soldiers, others that would have been present for that purpose. In Mark 42:43-52, it tells the events as they transpire. How did this mob come to them? Verse 43, immediately while he yet spake, cometh Judas, one of the 12, and with him a great multitude with what? Swords and staves. And it says they were all from who? Chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. These are the ones that organized this and sent these people. Now, we know that Jesus' disciples were prepared to some degree, but what did they have to defend themselves? Swords. Okay. They were no match for this. And there would have been really no reason to have sent such a mob to take Jesus had he ever tried to defend himself violently. No. In his teaching, he had opposed that aspect of it. He said, "My kingdom's not of this earth." Okay. What were they afraid of, though? Okay, I'm going to go just a bit deeper than that. If you were going to go try to take Jesus, what could he do? Exactly right. They had seen someone raised from the dead, and if he could bring a life back, he could certainly take a life if he desired to. Jesus will make the point later, what could he have called on? He could have called on legions of angels, if necessary, to defend himself. These people would have had to have understood that he had great power. If he chose to exercise it, he could. Would their swords and staves have really been of any... Okay. Verse 44, he that betrayed him had given him a token, saying, "Whomsoever I shall kiss, the same is he, take him and lead him away safely." Others will say, "Lead him away bound." How did Judas go about approaching Jesus? Verse 45. And as soon as he was come, he goes straightway to him and kissed and said, "Master, Master," and kissed him. They laid hands on him, took him. Look at a couple of the other in this particular event. How it relates to that. Look at Matthew 26. Matthew 26. Verse 49, and forthwith he came, Jesus said, "Hail, Master," and kissed him. And Jesus said unto him, "Friend, wherefore art thou come?" And then they came and they laid hands on Jesus and took him. Why would Jesus have called him a friend at that point? There's no right answer to this. This calls for speculation, just trying to get Judas to rest by talking to him. Chose him as one of his disciples. What could he have wanted him to do? Okay. Chose an opportunity. Jesus didn't have to say anything to Judas, but he chose to say something to him. He knows the reason specifically, but I would think that, again, Jesus said very little that wasn't for a reason. I think he said this for a reason to Judas to try and provoke him in some way to think. Okay? Continuing on, they bound him and they took him. There's further elaboration, though, on what actually happened. And I want to turn to, I believe it is John's account. The point is made that they several questions are asked. Verse 4, verse 3 of John 18, and Judas, when he received the band of men and officers, they gather with the torches and weapons. Verse 4, Jesus, therefore, knowing all things should come upon him, went forth and said unto them, what? Whom do you see? Okay. And they answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. And what did he tell him? I'm he. Okay. Was there a real need for Judas to have kissed him at this point? No, he's already identified himself, but that does take place as well. So there's no question in the chief priest's servants. Verse 6, and as soon as he had said unto them, I am he, what did the people do? Fell backward. This relates to the point that we made earlier. They had a healthy fear. I don't know that I would say it was respect, but a healthy fear of Jesus' capabilities. They fell backward to the ground. Another question was, Jesus posed the question, whom seek ye? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. He confirmed again, I have told you that I am he. If therefore ye seek me, let these go their way. Who's the these in this point? His disciples. He prayed earlier, before he went into the garden, on behalf of his disciples. Here, he makes a specific plea to the leaders to allow them to separate and go. For what reason? They be protected, that they be safe. Verse 9, that the saying might be fulfilled, which he spake of them, which thou gavest me, have I lost none. Then Simon, what did Peter do? Okay. He cut off the servant's ear. John's account doesn't specifically show the kissing or betrayal by Judas. We tie the two together. That it must have already transpired at this point. Peter is going forward now and trying to defend Jesus as they're coming to take him, and draws his sword and cuts off the ear of Malchus, the servant of the priest. What did Jesus tell him to do? Put his sword away. This is consistent with what other message Jesus has been telling his disciples all along. Not of this earth. Okay? No, I don't think there's any evidence that there's anything miraculous in it other than just a healthy personal fear that Jesus is the one that's been able to heal the lame. He's been able to raise people from the dead. You know, they are conscious that he has power to do many things. So they would have taken a step back. Now, if these servants had not been in the presence of Jesus before, and didn't recognize him on sight, you know, the fact that they walked up to him and just been told that this is Jesus, I'm he, they might take a step back. It would be logical, you know, I've run up on my prey and now I've found him, well, what am I going to do with him? Okay? Exactly right. There's no doubt about that. He's committed. Now, I think he's a bit impetuous. I think it's the best way to describe that. And he's not clearly thought through the ramifications, but he is there to protect the Savior, the Lord. Any other comments? Okay. He had certainly shown the will to try and be confrontational, but he had never done so in a manner that would have given them, you know, he would have gone to battle. But I really think the healthy respect here is for his capabilities and his power that he had. You know, his disciples would have no doubt told people about the stilling of the Galilee of the storm. So he had power over the elements. He had power over life and death. Had to have respect for that. That was very well. It's a good point. Jesus' response was not one of someone that was afraid to be caught. He stood up to him and said, I am he. I'm ready. That is a bit odd, isn't it? That he had to ask him twice before they really picked up on the aspect of it that he said he was who he said he was. Good point. Jesus' point. Right. That philosophy implied or improperly applied throughout the centuries. The Crusades were efforts to spread the gospel or spread the truth and take the holy lands away from the infidel Muslims and so on. But that wasn't the purpose of it. The kingdom was not to be defended in that way. Right. I think we see the examples of that persecuted in a way that would have limited openly. And that didn't prevent them from, us from worshiping. The fact that they're going to lose the king doesn't prevent the kingdom from coming into place, and it doesn't prevent the individuals from having a responsibility to continue to serve in the kingdom. Good point. Jesus instructs Peter about the sword. He tells him what to do with it now. Use of the sword is not the purpose. What does Jesus then do in response to this action that Peter has taken? Healed the ear that had been severed from the servant. If you were standing in that mob at that point, what would your thought have to be? Why am I here? But no, they were so filled with anger and hatred, stirred up by the priests and the scribes, that was not their response. It would have been something that would have occurred quickly, and I'm sure that initially the rest of the mob wouldn't have known that much about it, but we know later that it was well known among the people as they were talking about the events that there while Jesus was being tried. So, word spread quickly. Verse 12, and the band and the captain and the officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him, and they led him away to Annas first. Now, who was Annas at this point? Say he would have been the prior high priest. Caiaphas was the serving high priest. They took him to Annas first. He was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, which was the high priest the same year. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one should die for the people. Why would Caiaphas have said this? What was his thought process behind why Jesus should die? Afraid of what the Romans might do. The implication here is, in the prior verse though, the band... If the terminology relating to the band there, it's not necessarily a band of Jews, but who might have also been in this band of the mob, some of the Roman soldiers. And that was a point that I had not picked up on that Bob and Sandra made in their discussion of the individuals that would have been assembled in the mob itself. Jesus is taken to Annas. He's taken in a way that... What do the rest of his disciples do? What had all the disciples set up to this point that they were ready to do? Die for it. And though Jesus would have expected these things to transpire, now you have to feel that these are the people that just say would die for you, and what did they do? It's as if they were totally demoralized by the fact that Jesus didn't immediately tell them to fight. They didn't know what to do, so they fled. We see the young man in a linen garment fleeing to the point that his garment was taken. He's running away naked. We only see and have record of two individuals following Jesus. The location there is John and Peter. John goes into and asks that Peter come in and be within the courtyard area. They are assembling in front of some burn pots it was cool evidently to stay warm. And John's there, evidently known to the priest, and is asked that they be in this. But what starts happening to Peter at this point as he's warming himself? Start questioning Peter about whether or not, first off, aren't you one of his disciples? What was Peter's response? Nope, not one of his. I'm just here to watch the events. I want to see what's going to happen. I'm an observer. Now, who was it that first identified Peter as being one of the disciples? Mom, servant girl, young lady that kept the door. The next instance we see, they start saying, aren't you one of his disciples? And why did they say that you're one of his disciples? The accent. His speech betrayed him. And they said, you're a Galilean. Well, you're one of his, aren't you? And Peter again said, what? Now, by this time, what had already happened is a sideline thing that's occurred. Rooster had crowed at least, okay? Rooster had crowed. Now, Peter denied Jesus twice. Now, in the third instance we see occurring, change in Peter's response. How did his response change? He got much stronger in his response. So much stronger that he did what? Cursed. You know, he's pinned down now. You know, an animal gets pinned down, they fight back. Peter's fighting back in a way to try and dissuade them from believing that he's one of them. Well, would his behavior certainly have been contrary to what Jesus would have expected? Well, it would have been. But as he completes this, what two things happen next in the storyline? And you have to read each of the accounts to tie it all together. But he denies Jesus for the third time, and what happens? Rooster crows the second time. What else? Jesus looked at him. Now, what would have been significant about that? What had Peter said? I'm not going to deny you, not at all, no way, it's not ever going to happen. He probably would have used as strong a language as he could have to Jesus at that point to convince him otherwise. But what happened in Peter's heart at that point? What realization did he come to? Now, it took him three times, but it took the third time, and it took the rooster crowing for the second time, and it took Jesus looking at him for him to realize that what he had done, and the magnitude of what he had done, and how it was different from what he said he would be. He had denied the Savior. That's the first and foremost. He had contradicted his own beliefs of what he could believe he could do and was sent. And what was his response? Wept. Now, significant difference in people's response. You know, when David was confronted by Nathan, he was sorrowful. Judas shortly will be confronted with the magnitude of his choices and decisions. What does he do? Goes out and hangs himself. Peter wept at this point, but later we see over and over what was his response. He got stronger and stronger and stronger because he chose to focus his energies in a way that they needed to be. One could say that Judas was a marked man from the beginning because of the prophecies themselves. You wish that he would have been a person of different character. Prophecies would not have had to be level that they would have been. Gone forth and burst himself asunder in a field, and that he would have hoped that he would have had a response similar to Peter's. Similar to the other disciples, that over time, what did each of the other disciples do? They developed a stronger faith. What did it take for Thomas in the coming day, in the coming weeks? He had to see Jesus again and feel the nail prints to be able to have that faith built up in him. Other disciples will have to see the events transpire on the day of Pentecost for their faith to really be built to the point that they can stand and continue on. No. Well, it's the omniscience of God, not the omnipotence of God directing the events. It's God's all-knowingness that knew what events would transpire as a function of Judas's character, that he would kill himself. And he was just saying, this is what's going to happen. I'm not making it happen, but it is. And that's a good point to make the distinction with young people, that God's not using his power to drive this to an end, power to tell what's going to come about. Right. Okay. The last part of this is directly before the leaders there. They're bringing together witnesses against him. They had problems with the witnesses initially. What was the problem? They didn't agree. What was the Jewish law's requirement? They had to have two, and they had to be in agreement. Okay. What was the final charge that was lumped up or trumped up against Jesus? What did he say he would do? Rebuild the temple. What did he say would happen to the temple? Torn down and be built back in 3 days, not with hands. Now, that he was going to do that. It just said it was going to happen. Okay? But Annas, or the leadership, seizes upon a different... They don't necessarily take that, and they start to have problems with even that particular, because it's not one that's unto death. Even if he said he would do something like that, you know, it's not a cause for death, not a capital punishment, or a capital offense. What did they then choose to seize on? What did they ask him if he was the Son of God? What was his response? I am. I am he. Others say, ye say so. I am he. And what was the priest's response at that point? Blasphemy. Put him to death. Okay, what was the problem with that? They couldn't. Jews didn't have the authority to put someone to death. Romans were the only ones that had the authority to do that. And what was the requirement for that? To have committed a capital offense. Did the Romans care that Jesus would have blasphemed against Jehovah or anything else? Which it wasn't, because he was deity and he was who he said he was. It didn't matter at that point. Anything that they could use, they could use the argument that he had blasphemed against God with what group of individuals? Jews themselves, the people. They needed something they could leverage to finally turn all of the people. Again, that would have been one that would have. For someone to have claimed to have been the Son of God. Why would it have been so hard to imagine that Jesus was looking any different than... The only thing that testified that he was different was what? The miracles that he had performed. So if you took him in the context of a room, claimed to be deity, it would have been difficult for people to grab onto that and accept that. They used this idea of the blaspheme against God, or claiming to be equal to God, and said, let's stone him. That's what ensued with them taking them then to Pilate, trying to get Pilate to have him killed. We'll begin with that next time. Actually, I'll get it next Sunday. Okay. Thank you for your attention. Any comments?